You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello and welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Wilberg, editor at allyoucanheat.com and the host of this fine program. With me on the other line, as always, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. Still feeling the buzz after the opening night of Miami Heat basketball, coming off a big win over the Orlando Magic and looking forward to previewing the upcoming game against the Charlotte Hornets.
Yeah, did you say buzz on purpose? Because we have our friend over here, Chris Barnwell of At The Hive and many other places, joining us on the show. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing all right.
Using a straw to suck up life?
Yeah, it's just, of course. I like straws. I cannot bounce off that.
Well, you sound excited to be here, so I'm glad you're here. So we're going to talk about the Miami Heat game against the Hornets Friday night. But before we get to that, we did want to cover a few other things. Mostly Pablo Torre's profile on Tyler Johnson for ESPN.com. Really full-length profile on Tyler Johnson's story, specifically how he got signed. He came out of nowhere and got signed to a $50 million contract and then puked not once but twice. Would you puke, David, if you got $50 million right now?
I'm pretty sure I wouldn't stop puking for at least a few days. I'd be pretty excited about it, to be honest with you. I mean, but the piece was pretty eye-opening, I think, because, you know, obviously there's been a lot of controversy over Tyler's re-signing with Miami. I know you and I have been somewhat critical of the deal, at least, you know, moving forward, particularly in years 3 and 4. And Torre doesn't shy away.
Hold on. What do you mean I've been critical of the deal? I love the deal.
You have said some negative things about that balloon payment in years 3 and 4. I know that you've said that, you know, if you average it out to $12.5 million a year, that seems like a good deal, but paying $20 million for him in year 4 seems excessive.
That doesn't sound like
you did say this.
I don't know.
Well, it's been a few months of marinating and going over. Anyway, the point is he's playing fairly well, and Torre doesn't shy away from the fact that this is a huge contract for a guy that a lot of people didn't know, and that, you know, as he mentions, you know, Tyler's become kind of like the poster child for being overpaid and the new improved salary cap and everything else. But there was a lot of details there about how Tyler's come up, you know, throughout his career, not just in the NBA, but also collegiately and through high school, the things he's had to face as far as adversity and the number of injuries that he's incurred, that he just keeps finding a way to play through those. So it kind of changed my opinion about him and kind of had me leaning more towards that maybe he might actually pan out and be worth this kind of money.
Maybe it's that I just watched more Heat than other random people, but when I saw the initial like contract offer he got from the Nets, I was like, oh, that's actually pretty good, because I knew he was a pretty good player and I thought he could get even better than what he was. Like, obviously it was risky, and maybe it was a little risky initially for the Heat to like immediately sign him back, but then like obviously they're building now, so I think having a young guy on that contract that can only get better from there, like, I don't see how it gets any worse for them.
Well, I think it's partly the backlash that it was like within a day or two of when, you know, Dwayne Wade had signed with Chicago, and obviously a lot of that was about money, at least what we heard publicly. And though, you know, he's kind of angling for a couple million here and there from an organization that he spent 13 years with, and Miami was unwilling to pay it. And, you know, you hear things from Pat Riley that he hasn't really communicated effectively with Wade. And all of a sudden, Mickey Arison is willing to pay $50 million to this kid who, you know, has suffered through a number of injuries in his limited tenure in Miami. You know, may not exactly pan out. Sure, he's shown flashes. There's a lot of athleticism and everything else. But I think those two things were kind of tied together. And so I think that's where some negativity has played into it. At least it did for me, I'll be honest with you.
Well, and I understand that, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because in this piece, he even talks about thinking that he was going to be in Brooklyn, and the fact that his fiance ordered Brooklyn Nets clothes for their child, and all this stuff, and you hear about Pat Riley's handling of the Dwayne Wade situation, that maybe he wasn't communicating with him enough, and that Wade was kind of left out of the loop and didn't really know what was happening. I mean, what? How was he communicating with Tyler Johnson? Tyler Johnson thought he was going to Brooklyn. He was buying baby clothes with Nets logos on them. I mean, I think this whole communication thing, it's kind of funny how it affects some players and it doesn't affect other players, because Tyler Johnson was through the moon when he or was over the moon when he found out that he was going back to Miami, you know? You could tell that by this piece. He was very happy to get that deal from Brooklyn, was prepared to go there, obviously, but, you know, very grateful to come back to Miami. All that being, I think Heat fans do look at it that way, and I wish they wouldn't, because it did... It's not Tyler Johnson's fault, and I think a lot of people started... Tyler Johnson was a fan favorite for the first 2 years that he was in Miami, year and a half. And then kind of, like, immediately became, like, the, oh, you're not Wade, but we're giving you Wade's money, even though I think that that was taken out of context, because if we believe the reports now, the Heat did offer every dollar that they had to Wade at the end of there, and Wade, at that point, like, that relationship was severed, so Wade signed with Chicago. And then they went and signed Tyler Johnson. It wasn't like they picked Tyler Johnson and were like, hey, Wade, we don't have any money left. Like, see ya. Like, that wasn't really the case. But I don't want to talk too much about that. I really want to talk about this profile, because we've talked about Tyler Johnson and that contract enough. But one of the things that really popped out for me in that profile was that I always wondered why he hasn't fixed his tooth. And he's just like, he literally said, I'm just rocking it for now. And I love that answer. He's just like, I don't really want to fix it. And that really, to me, humanized him, because I hate going to the dentist. And if I don't have to go, I'm like, I don't really want to go. Maybe if I had a tooth knocked out, I'd say, maybe I should go. But I kind of get where Tyler is coming from. I'm like, yeah, if I don't, like, I got basketball and stuff going on, I don't want to deal with the dentist. He's like, I'm just going to rock it for now.
Yeah.
If he becomes, like, a star of any kind, that tooth is going to become a marketing masterpiece, like Anthony Davis's unibrow.
Yeah,
I always wondered if Anthony Davis was going to shave that unibrow once he got so big that he didn't need the unibrow anymore. You know what I mean? Like, he's big enough of a star. We know who he is. We know his face. But he doesn't need the unibrow. But you're like, he's got the whole thing trademarked. Tyler Johnson should have that toothless thing just trademarked. Like, we should just make him, like, a, what's that thing from Alice in Wonderland, the Cheshire Cat?
Yes.
You know how, like, the teeth show up before the cat? That should be Tyler Johnson. You know, just, like, all his teeth except one, and then the rest of them shows up.
You've got the beard in James Harden, you've got the brow, and now we have the gap in Tyler Johnson. So it works out perfectly. I think that's his nickname. Instead of Bumpy, let's call him the Gap from now on.
Let's do that, the Gap, because also he probably shops at the Gap.
Not with $50 million, you know.
No, that's true. He used to shop at the Gap based on his old suits. Love the Gap. If you're listening, you want to sponsor the show, we'd love to have you. But
we'd absolutely. I wear all of your jeans and plaid shirts all the time.
Mm-hmm. I have a pair of jeans.
I'm wearing multiple pairs of jeans right now.
I'm wearing three pairs of Gap jeans at the moment. It's cold in Northern California. Anything else?
Brag about it. Why don't you?
What is it in Orlando right now?
Let me pull that up really quick.
Okay, I thought you had this information in front of you. You gotta be prepared.
Low 70.
Why would I have weather information in front of me?
Another thing that stood out to me was
he was
73.
Yes,
that's
nice. Complaining about Chris. The other thing that stood out to me in that profile was that he held his meetings in Chicago, where his agents were based, and when the Nets called Johnson's agents with that $50 million offer. Not only we knew the barfing stories, like those were well documented. Like we knew he threw up eventually. The other thing that he did first was that he caught it, and this is what Torrey wrote: one that caused him to lie face down on the carpet of their office. There being the agent's office. Like I'm picturing Tyler Johnson with no tooth lying face down on the carpet of his agent's office, and that was his reaction to $50 million. I mean, this guy's reaction is priceless in every sort of way.
Yeah, and you know, it's also interesting. He called his mom, and he said, we made it, you know, when he first heard the offer. And so many of
we made
the
it, and I'm
aspects.
Taking you with me.
Right, right.
Or
yeah.
No, that's,
and there's
that's
just so much
quote,
to it.
Sorry, yeah.
No, and you know, the excitement from his fiance and everything else, but so often, and Torrey does mention this, that, you know, a lot of fans, not just Heat fans, but fans in sport in general, tend to sympathize with billionaire owners over millionaire players for whatever reason, the weird construct of how labor negotiations work and everything else. But this adds such a real face to it. I mean, the fact that he's just a regular guy who had a really, you know, is really athletic, but he could just as easily have washed out of the league. And from 1 year to the next, all of a sudden he's getting paid this, you know, incredible amount of money, and it might be well deserved. But that, who cares if it is or not? Somebody's willing to pay him that, and that's right. part of the American dream as far as what we're all concerned with. I mean, we all want to get paid for doing what we do, and to get that kind of money and to react the way he does so excitedly, so nervously, to the point where he's puking and lying face down and all this and calling his parents and family and friends and things like that. That's just great. That's a really good, heartwarming story.
And the fact that he's so open about, yeah, I understand why people would think I'm overpaid. Like, I get that. Like, I'm not a household name. Like, I get it. And he's so, like, transparent and open about that. It's like, dude, like, we were alluding to earlier, like, there was some resentment towards him because the Heat had paid him and not Dwayne Wade, and that's an understandable resentment from the fan base. But it's like, if you're, put yourself in Tyler Johnson's shoes, get rid of all of that, you know, Heat fan noise, and you're just like, here's $50 million. You're like, hell yeah, dude. Like, I'm taking that. And even to the point where it's so unexpected even for him. Like, we tend to think that these guys know more than we do. They don't know anything more than we do a lot of times. And he gets a phone call, and he says, here's $50 million. Like, just literally probably hours before the report that he was offered $50 million came out, you know? So yeah. It really is pretty it's pretty great to get that human reaction. Another thing that I like before, and we'll move on after this, but last season there was a little bit of a report that Spoelstra had to tell Tyler Johnson to get out of the gym because he was practicing when he was injured. And
which goes against every Instagram comment ever.
What do you mean, every Instagram comment ever?
Do you know how every time a player posts like a picture of them doing anything besides like working out, every comment from a fan will be, you should be in the gym right now.
Chandler Parsons' comments section are great because like he isn't like able to play and he's like on the beach or like at a Lakers game or on the whatever. But yeah, exactly. And Eric Spoelstra, so Pablo Torre kind of dives into that story. So I'm just going to read this little section. Spoelstra just wanted to ensure that Johnson in rehab was following doctor's orders and not rushing back for the playoffs that spring. No, 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 don't worry about me, Johnson assured. So what's this? Spoelstra replied, before hitting play on an office monitor. Arena security footage, taken shortly before midnight, unmistakably showed Johnson sneaking into dude's rolls on the court. The punishment? $500 for an, quote-unquote, unsupervised workout without clearance from a team physician, end quote. An infraction, Spoelstra admits, that he had to invent on the spot. I want that scene to be in a movie. The movie doesn't have to be about basketball, Tyler Johnson, Eric Spoelstra. It doesn't, like, just put it in the middle of Ocean's 11 or something. I don't care. Just give me that. I want a picture of Spoelstra, like, calling Tyler Johnson into his office, you know, after a practice or something. Like, Tyler, come into my office just for a second before you leave. And Tyler Johnson's like, oh, yeah, cool, no problem. Sits down. Yeah, and he's like, I'm concerned that you're working a little too hard. And Tyler Johnson's like, me? No, me? Work too hard? Never. And Spoelstra's like, really? What's this? And hits like a giant red button on his desk. And then like this video of him, like Tyler Johnson, like a black hoodie sneaking into the gym and then just putting up like shots from the free throw line or something. Like, I need that image. I need to see that footage.
There are definite Hollywood elements to that, right? Like the footage is all grainy and black and white for some reason, even though we're in 2016. Right. It just looks all clandestine and everything. And Tyler Johnson sneaking past everybody just to get in there and put up shots.
Sleeping security guard.
Yeah. It's a great image. And I would definitely pay money to go see that. Although I don't think Ocean's 11 is the right place for it.
What movie would we go in?
The Gap, the Tyler Johnson story on Lifetime. Come on.
Wow.
I love it.
Like, that is on the tree of low-hanging fruit jokes. David just found the one with, like, worms in it.
I like that. I'm a low-hanging kind of guy, though. Jesus. All right, let's move on. Josh McRoberts, on the DL, came off of the injury report, just kind of was just not on it anymore after he had been on it for what seems like 4 years now. So we think he's probably going to play mostly backup center from the reports.
Wait, center?
Backup center, yeah.
Yeah.
That's weird.
But given how well Willie Reed played in Miami's first game, David, do you think Josh McRoberts will play in this first game, or do you think it'll still be a little bit more of a slower introduction to his first game this season?
Yeah, I don't actually see him playing just yet unless there's an obvious need for some kind of offense there that maybe he's capable of providing that you know, nobody else on the roster is. Interestingly enough, there was another piece by Ira Winderman, I guess in his Q&A with fans. You know, they asked about Derek Williams and his fit. You know, strangely, him and Udonis Haslam were the only two players not to play in the season opener against Orlando. And it seems like he may or may not have fallen out of favor with Eric Spoelstra. You know, Luke Babbitt obviously started. James Johnson came in now. And as Winderman alludes to, the addition of Mick Roberts would complicate that because I think there's a skill set that Spoelstra trusts in Mick Roberts, even if his health has been in question, and something maybe that he doesn't necessarily have in Derek Williams. So he might be the odd man out. There's certainly more flexibility there with Mick Roberts that you can put him at the four or five, although I think they found a comfort zone with Willie Reed, who responded pretty favorably and has shown some real positive, you know, energy off the bench and everything else. And he seems like a pretty strong addition to the team. So I don't know at this point. I don't see Mick Roberts playing immediately. But if he does play, he's probably leapfrogged for whatever reason Derek Williams in the rotation.
There's we have to keep in mind that he got hurt before training camp, so he didn't get to play in training camp or preseason or anything. So it's going to take him a little bit even longer to kind of get back into playing shape. I think he'll be practicing with the team for now, doing pregame shoot-arounds and things like that because he's cleared to play, and that's good. I think maybe you see him in garbage time in these next couple games. If there's any garbage time at all, maybe you just throw him in there just to get him back on the court. But I agree, it probably doesn't play, and wouldn't be surprised if he did play some power forward, given how light the Heat are at that position. It doesn't hurt to have him there. But, I don't know, man. It'll be interesting to see if he can bounce back. We hope that he does, because his skill set would add a lot, particularly to this team. And I think we said that even last season, but really even more so this season, with the way this team wants to swing the ball and get out and transition and everything like that. Mick Roberts is perfect. When he's healthy, he could play point forward for you. That would be great. I know, Chris, you got to see him play for Charlotte, his best basketball of his career, probably.
Yes, he is an incredible passer. And that Hornets, they were the Bobcats at the time, that Charlotte team that he played for had absolutely no shooting, which I kind of would compare the Heat to the same thing. They don't really have a very high amount of, like, dead-eye shooters on this roster.
Yeah. Don't forget Luke Babbitt.
Well, they do have Luke Babbitt, which I'm honestly surprised he's still in the league. Mick Roberts is an incredible passer, and he's really good at creating space with that passing. He finds cutters, which is going to benefit guys like Justice Winslow really well. Guys like Bronte Weber, who, you know, he's really good with the ball in his hands, but if you want to, like, kind of have him play some off-ball, he can do that. So Mick Roberts is, if he's healthy, he can really help you out in that category. Your one problem is that he doesn't always shoot, and it's really annoying. So sometimes teams will play off of him, and you basically have to just beg him to shoot the ball. So that might be a bit of an issue.
Is that something you noticed in Charlotte?
I did. Like, he would be open in the corner, and he'd be always looking for the pass, like option 1, 2, and 3, before he would actually pull up for the shot. He very rarely shot the ball.
So that's new to his time in Miami, because that's a big pet peeve of Miami Heat fans for Josh McGrath.
Oh, yeah. It's him. Obviously, I can probably look it up right now, but he is not someone that wants to shoot the ball.
I remember.
But he did shoot a career high from 3-point range that last season with the Bobcats. I thought that was indicative of the fact that he was not just an able shooter, but a willing one as well. So we thought, you know, with the number of injuries he's had here and the fact that his shot just simply wasn't following during the limited appearances he did have, we also assumed that maybe he just had lost confidence and he just wasn't willing or trying to find a way to, you know, ingratiate himself to his teammates and things of that sort. But I guess that's something dating back, maybe that's a different story.
Looking at Basketball Reference, I think it's just because he had so many more minutes in Charlotte. Like, with Miami so far, the most he's played is that 14-17 range, and that's really his entire career. But he has 7.3 attempts per game when he's playing 30 minutes. So I think if he's playing a lot, he'll eventually shoot. And the majority of his shots were three-pointers, I'm going to bet, from the corner. But that wasn't really because of him being a willing shooter. I think he was just on the floor so much that they had to have him. So he had to shoot at some point.
What I'm looking forward to with Mick Roberts, if he can stay healthy, he can get on the court, is a lineup with Mick Roberts at the 4, Whiteside at the 5, and then Justice Winslow at small forward. Because I think at that point, whichever two guards you pair up with them, those are four guys who can handle the ball, facilitate all around Hassan Whiteside. I think that that's even if Mick Roberts and Winslow aren't great shooters, they create enough spacing with their ability to handle the ball that and they're good enough shooters, I think, that has a lineup with a lot of legs that could be really interesting to watch. But let's talk more about both of these teams have played a game already. David and I, we had already recapped Miami's game with the Magic. I don't know, a day later, is there anything, David, that maybe kind of strikes you that we didn't get a chance to talk about after game one?
There were a number of statistics that I had seen kind of tossed out there, but I don't think, I guess mostly, you know, one that really stood out, and I think you and I did talk about this, was, you know, Hassan Whiteside's impact defensively.
He was good.
Yes. Thank you, Chris. That is a perfect reaction. He was really good. And I think we're seeing that. And I think statistically there were 11 shots taken at the rim with Whiteside defending and only one actually fell. So that's a pretty good percentage.
Wow.
And you know, we talked about it. We talked about it yesterday. We talked about it before. He just seems bigger, larger, stronger than everybody out there. And he's clearly affecting players' ability to drive to the rim. Even some quotes that I don't know if you got a chance to see those, Wes, but that were sent over to me by the Orlando Magic PR, you know, from Nikola Vucevic, you know, who kept saying, I guess they were talking about it as far as their planning was concerned, that they knew ahead of time not to go at Whiteside. And for whatever reason, they completely abandoned that philosophy in the third quarter, went at him, and were promptly rejected. And that's where Miami was able to build their biggest lead. So for whatever reason, they kind of just, you know, dropped their game plan. And they went at Whiteside, and it was to their detriment, and they just weren't able to capitalize on that. So I'm curious to see if that's consistent in game two. I know we're going to talk about the Hornets a little bit more, but, you know, with notable Miami Heat villain Roy Hibbert in the lineup, I'm curious to see if that'll continue for Whiteside.
Yeah, the whole going right there's kind of a mantra that says when you're playing a shot blocker, go right at him. Right. And I think that's like a basketball player's thing, like that they say that just so that they don't have that fear. But that's like the wrong thing to do against Hassan Whiteside. I get that he has like moments where he has defensive lapses and he does chase blocks a little too much. But most of the time he's blocking their shot. So
yeah, not if they're going right at him. I mean, this is a guy who's had triple doubles in blocks. I mean, you know he's gonna get double digits.
I forget what team, but like they were like, we're gonna dare Peyton Manning to beat us. This is like when he was with the Colts, like years and years and years ago. But I think they're like, yeah, we're gonna dare Peyton Manning to beat us, and Peyton was like, dope. And then he beat them. He like threw for like 500 yards and like six touchdowns or something. That's like what these guys like. Let's just go right at Whiteside. It's like, cool, thanks, we'll do that.
My favorite thing about Whiteside is that when he blocks the ball, he doesn't just block it. He takes out like any anger that might be reserved in his body on the ball. He hits it as hard as he possibly can.
But keeps it in bounds.
Well, on a couple of occasions.
Kind of incredible.
Yeah, a couple of occasions. Yeah, most of the time he swats it, you know, pretty delicately and seems to find a way to control it. But there was that one block against Orlando that he just, I forgot who it was who went at him and he just.
I want to say it was Vooch where he just hit it, like you could hear the smack on TV.
And then there was one against
Alfred. Thrust it down to the ground, yeah.
And then one against Alfred Payton that he just caught the ball.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is amazing to me how he can do that. So impressions after Heat 1 is that game 1 of the Miami Heat is that Whiteside's awesome and scary.
And Justice Winslow is a really, really awesome defender, and it's going to be amazing.
So you were impressed with Winslow?
He was harassing the heck out of those perimeter guys. Like, I know the Magic can't shoot, like, at all, but he was a harasser.
Yeah, he seems to just... You're right. The Magic can't shoot, and even despite that, he was still harassing them around the perimeter. We see so often in the NBA, especially nowadays, that teams will just like play off of guys. Winslow doesn't give up any space, and that's okay because you're not worried about somebody blowing by him because he's got such good lateral quickness that playing up on somebody doesn't risk, you know, most guys aren't going to be able to get around him, so that's interesting that you brought that up.
Yeah, I don't know if you caught that when you were watching it, but on a couple of occasions, like Aaron Gordon was trying to make a move while he was being defended by Winslow, and I guess he dropped his shoulder, and Winslow kind of cocked his head back, at least on two occasions that I noticed, where he had made contact with him, but he didn't flop, he didn't take the foul, there was no foul called, but he just kept defending him despite the contact. I mean, Gordon's a pretty athletic guy, pretty big guy in his own right, So to think that Winslow keeps taking these kinds of hits defensively and is still engaged and locked in and able to limit a player's ability to score, I mean, that's pretty impressive stuff.
All right, let's move on to the Hornets. I didn't get, just full disclosure, I didn't get a chance to watch this game. I wanted to, I didn't get a chance. Before we get into your guys' reactions, which I really want to hear, Doug Branson, host of Locked On Hornets, did have a chance to break down game one and provide a little bit of analysis. So here's Doug Branson with that.
Well, the Hornets are coming off a big road win in Milwaukee, where they staved off a fourth quarter run from Giannis and company to get the opening night win over the Bucks, 107-96. Two big stories out of this game. First of all, the all-out rim assault on offense led by Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, who missed all but seven games last season. He played aggressively all night long, really looked like a guy who wanted to get back out there in a regular season game. He finished this one with 23 points and 14 rebounds. The Hornets may be built slightly different on offense than the team that Heat fans remember from the first round playoff series. Here's Coach Clifford after Wednesday's game.
A lot of the things that we did well tonight were things that we struggled with last year. You know, last year we were a good offensive team, but if you look at it, it was really relying on, we got to the free throw line pretty well and we made threes, but our two-point shooting and our points in the paint and stuff weren't good. And tonight, I felt like we were a lot better than that.
The second big story out of Wednesday, the Hornets allowing a few too many points in the paint and transition points for head coach Steve Clifford's liking. But he has to like what new acquisition and starting center Roy Hibbert gave them. 15 points, 9 rebounds, 3 assists, and 5, count them, 5 block shots. His rim protection and one-on-one defense will certainly be tested against Hassan Whiteside on Friday. But it was his passing that was also the talk of fans and media. The big man with the skills to deliver the kick out to the corner, but also the drop-off to the Hornets' many slashing wings. Another thing that Clifford liked about his defense and something Heat fans should keep an eye on is the ability for the Hornets to switch screens amongst Nick Batum, MKG, and Marvin Williams. If executed properly, it allows help defenders to retreat back to the rim or clog the paint for easy strips. On the injury front, backup power forward Frank Kaminsky is still dealing with a strained right foot injury that kept him out of the first contest. No word yet on his status for Friday, but he very well could miss the entire first week of games. From Charlotte, Doug Branson, Locked On Hornets.
Okay, thanks again to Doug, Locked On Hornets. Chris, what were your impressions of the Hornets after game one?
That they are so immensely better than Milwaukee, it's kind of hilarious.
Okay.
Milwaukee was so bad compared to them.
Yeah.
Like, Milwaukee, outside...
Milwaukee seems like a team that we keep wanting to be good. Like, we're almost wishing them to be good, and it's just not working. I don't want to, like... derail this conversation too much.
Okay, I don't want to see another freaking thing about Point Giannis ever again until he's actually good at being Point Giannis.
Ooh. Yeah.
He was not good at that last night.
We wrote enough about the possibility of the hypothetical Point Giannis, and the next phase of Point Giannis is him being good at being Point Giannis, and then we get to write those articles.
Right, like, I get the whole thing, and it's not like he was terrible. He shot the ball really well last night, but he just, as a point guard, he didn't really do that much to help the Bucks themselves. And sure, the team as a whole, like, was probably worse than him, but that doesn't mean that, like, he was this amazing like player for them.
All right, so speaking of forwards that you like then, because I know you're very high on Michael Kidd-Gilchrist.
Michael Kidd-Gilchrist ate up Giannis.
So Michael Kidd-Gilchrist and Nick Batum on the perimeter, what did the Heat have to expect from that? How can they possibly attack that perimeter tandem?
It's going to be interesting because the Heat don't shoot very much, which means the Hornets, who they naturally play this style on defense where they kind of like hang back and like let the team kind of come. If they'll leave their perimeter guys like kind of by themselves that and kind of hang back to, you know, help protect the rim a little more. And it makes up when they have slower guys like Hibbert down there on the near the rim. So I'm very curious how they're going to be able to get around guys like MKG and Batum, because they're not going to be able to use the pick and roll because they can switch basically anything. Mm-hmm. So what I think they're really going to have to do is they're really going to have to rely on a guy like a Whiteside that can crash as hard as possible, bring Hibbert out you know, create space for themselves. Like, we kind of saw this last year when they had Wade, where they would go into that really high pick and roll in the elbow, and they would create space for themselves in that area, and then they kind of kick out to the corner. So they might try and do that again. I'm not sure how much it'll work with now that MKG's playing, but it's worth a trying again. I mean, it worked so well for them in the playoffs.
Well, it's, I think also without Luol Deng and Joe Johnson, it's not going to work as well. Unfortunately, you just don't have, at least from Miami's perspective, you just don't have those kinds of shooters that you can position on the corner for a pass like that. It's going to be a lot more. We saw that against Orlando. They shot horrifically from the perimeter. And although you expect that to improve just because it can't get any worse, I just don't think that Miami's capable of shooting. So you're going to have to do a lot of work at the rim. And unfortunately, you do have a shot blocker like Hibbert there. You have some outstanding perimeter defenders too, some long guys like MKG and Batum and everything else that can really hurt you. So maybe we'll see a lot more from Dragic. Obviously, I think he was able to work pretty effectively against Kemba Walker last year during the playoffs, and there were some heated moments there. I think that'll be an interesting one. And I'm curious to see how Dion Waiters, who's likely to start in the second game, I wonder how he's going to be able to handle MKG, because, I mean, that's a pretty interesting matchup, I think.
Yeah, and just to Chris's point about the pick and roll that they used, they're really, just like you're saying, David, there's not going to be as much space, and without that much space, you know, Batum and MKG, they could play off of guys like Winslow, and with their long arms can really get in the way of Dragic trying to get the ball to Whiteside, even though I think the obvious weakness on the Hornets' defense is Kemba Walker, and you'd expect Goran Dragic, the most talented offensive player that you have, to go right after that, him, and maybe Spoelstra will find a way to leverage that. But those long arms of MKG and Nick Batum, I'm expecting. I think the Heat only had 10 turnovers in Game One. I'm expecting a lot more this game.
But even with Kemba being their weakest defender, he's still a pretty smart defender and kind of knows where to place himself.
Yes.
So while he's the weak defender, I wouldn't call him he's not an easy guy to score on. Like, Dragic isn't just going to be able to isolate him up and then get points, because the Hornets will adjust and Kemba will adjust.
Yeah, and they don't have in the playoffs, the things that they used was, yes, Wade was able to make some threes there in the last couple games. Luol Deng had a really hot start for the first three or four games of that series, was hitting threes a lot. And then the other thing was Dwayne Wade posting up their guards. And they don't have a post-up guard like that to take advantage of, to try to invert that offense and try to take advantage of Charlotte's smaller guards. So I do wonder how the Heat are going to attack. Yeah, Whiteside had a really good series, but that, I think he was feeding off of a lot of what Wade was doing in that series. So it'll be interesting to see how the Heat are able to figure out, because the Hornets, I mean, these are two of the best coaches in the Eastern Conference. It's always really fun to watch these two games, because Steve Clifford and Eric Spoelstra really get their teams going, I think, for these games.
If Miami's really going to get anything going in this matchup, I don't think it's going to be against the starters. I really think it's going to be against the bench, because in the Milwaukee game, the Hornets were up 23 points at one point, and then the bench just, they let them back in it late. So I feel like if Miami's going to do anything against them, they could do something to that bench. They have some really athletic guys on that bench that can cause some problems for a Charlotte team that really got weaker in that area this year with the loss of Al Jefferson and Jeremy Lin.
I'm trying to think who they have on their bench. They got Cody Zeller. He'll probably come off the bench, right, as he's still recovering from injury. They got Ramon Sessions at point. Who else is really the key players off as far as Clifford's rotation?
Well, Marco Bellinelli played a lot.
Good point, yeah.
And I don't know who's going to be the other big man, because Spencer Hawes played last night, but Frank Kaminsky was hurt.
That's right.
So it's going to be one of those two. Don't expect to see much of Jeremy Lamb. He's not good.
Okay.
Well, no, I mean,
he's just not.
It's funny because, you know, he got traded to Charlotte, and for a few months there while they were dealing with injury, he was like the great hope, and they re-signed him to that great extension and everything else, and then he just kind of started stinking again. You know, it was everything that we had seen in Oklahoma City, all the inconsistency, the boneheaded plays and everything else, the lack of interest and energy, and that's finally become obvious there, I think, in Charlotte. I'm sorry. No. Sorry, Chris.
It's a good point. Miami, three of their four guys that played off the bench scored in double figures in that opening game. So
this could be a really weird game where, the Hornets start off hot. It's like, uh-oh, the Heat are in trouble. Then the bench comes in and they make a push, then it kind of goes back and forth for a while. It's going to be really interesting to see who kind of plays late.
Right. The game was at Milwaukee, right? So you would have expected them to have that kind of advantage as far as the home crowd and everything else. And tomorrow's game is going to be in Miami, so that should be an interesting one.
Charlotte Road Warriors. Yeah, the first two games are on the road. That's rough.
Yeah.
Huh. The NBA hates Charlotte, clearly.
Obviously. They love Miami.
It's a conspiracy. I'm telling you.
That's why Goran Dragic always gets all the calls.
Clearly.
All right, well, that's all we have for today. Whether you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, thank you for listening. Get in touch with the show on Twitter at LockedOnHeat or by email, or you can send us mailbag questions, comments, or sponsorship opportunities, especially if you're The Gap. Right. That's LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. If you aren't subscribed already, please do so to get the podcast automatically every day. Rate us, review us, say nice things about us. We'll catch you next time. Thanks, Chris, for joining us.
No problem. I had fun.
And thanks, David, as always.
You got it, Wes.